The following sermon by the Puritan Stephen Charnock, taken from his collected works, Volume 5, Man's Enmity to God. How desperate is the atheism in every man's heart, by nature. What a mass of villainy is in the heart of man. What, to make God no God? Set up our wills against the will of God? When we say an enemy to God, we must conceive all that may denominate a man base and abominable. What more can be added than to say such a man is an enemy to love itself? Sin and God are at direct odds. To harbor a traitor in a house after proclamation is a capital crime, and comes under the charge of high treason. What then is a harboring of sin against God, but involving thyself in the same rebellion which every sin includes in its own nature? Disenmity to God has this aggravation in it, that it cannot upon any account whatsoever be just. God himself cannot command a creature not to love him. Before he can command this, he must change his nature, cashier his loveliness, cease to be the chief good. God cannot command anything unjust, but this is intrinsically unjust, eternally unjust, not to love that which is infinitely amiable. It had been unjust to command an act of the highest disingenuity and ingratitude, to hate the author of our mercies. It had been against the original nature of a rational creature to be an enemy to that which is its chiefest good. Our loving God does not arise merely from the command of God enjoining it, but from the nature of God and the creature's relation to him. None but will confess that had God never commanded us to love him, it had been highly abominable for a creature to hate his maker and benefactor. Therefore, in the moral law or decalogue, the love of God is not explicitly commanded, but supposed as a fundamental and indispensable principle, from which all other commands are necessary consequences, so that this very enmity against God is not only against his command, but against his very nature, and against the fundamental and indispensable principle of all God's commands, and all the duties which as rational creatures we owe to God. The desperateness of this natural enmity will appear, number one, in that it is as bad, and in some respects worse, than atheism. We complain much, and not without cause, of the growing atheism of the times, but we shall find as bad and worse than we complain of in our own nature and the practices of men. Mirandula says, a speculative atheist is the most prodigious monster in the world, but a practical. An atheist that denies the being of God does not so much affront him as a natural man that owns his being, but walks as if there were no God, as if he were not a just and righteous God, as if he made use of his sovereign power to make laws for the prejudice of his creature. The atheist barely denies God's being. The other mocks him. They have turned to me the back and not the face. Jeremiah 32:33. This puts a slight upon him, turning the back upon him, which is an act of disdain, as if God were the most contemptible being in the world. Thou that turnest thy face to the dog, thy beast, the devil, uses God with more contempt than you use your dog, your swine, your ox, your ass, yea, the devil himself. The atheist that denies God's being and yet walks according to moral principles is like the son in the gospel that told his father he would not go and yet did, which Christ commends above the other, which acknowledged his father's authority to command him and pretended a readiness to obey, but answered not his acknowledgments by the performance of his duty. A profane man or a hypocrite is more an atheist than one that professes himself so, inasmuch as actions and a continual succession and circle of them makes a greater discovery of the principles of the heart than the motions of the tongue. Would not that man who in his belief of a deity doth things which fall under the censor of God's justice and contrary to his law, and odious among men, though not punishable by man, do things far worse, Did not the fear of laws, the anger of his prince, the pain and disgrace of punishment restrain him? Surely he would, for that principle which carries him against his reason and professed religion and his practices against God would hurry him further were there not some powerful limit set to him by human laws. Now what is this evince but that he honors man more than God, fears man more than God, obeys man more than God, owns the power of man more than the power of God, which he pretends to acknowledge and believe. The atheist denies God's being, the other his authority, and in denying his authority virtually denies his being, for it is a contradiction to be God and not to be sovereign. Does not man imply by the breaking of God's laws that he would not have God act as a sovereign, that he would have him reign but a careless God, an unholy and unrighteous God, and given him the reins and not prohibiting by holy laws any wickedness his heart is inclined unto? What then would become of God's being? His deity cannot outlive the life of his authority and righteousness. If he ceased to be a righteous lawgiver and a holy maintainer of his laws, he would cease to be a God. So that every breach of the law is a virtual deposing him from his supreme government. So that every breach of the law is a virtual deposing him from his supreme government, and consequently a virtual deposing him from his deity. Number two, this enmity is of the same nature with the devil's enmity. It is not indeed in the present state in which man is so intense, because his is direct, man's implicit. But yet, number one, natural men have a diabolical nature. There are but two seeds, the seed of the woman and that of the serpent. Two natures, the divine and diabolical. Satan is a father of wicked men, and fathers derive their nature to their children. He is not their father by creation, nor by generation, but by a diffusion of his principles into them. You are of your father, the devil. John 8:44. God made man in creation according to his own image, and the devil quickly by corruption brings him into his likeness. In Scripture is not meant by the devil only a particular person, but a nature. So Christ intimates in his rebuke to Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Matthew 16:23. Peter, an eminent apostle who had a little before made an illustrious profession of Christ being the Son of God, verses 16 and 17, is now called devil. Not because he was really the person of the devil, but the devil's nature did then exert itself in him. For that advice proceeded not from a divine but diabolical disposition. For it made directly for the serving the devil's kingdom, which was only to be overthrown by the death of Christ. Hell itself could not produce a more devilish result of its deepest counsels than in the advice which Peter now gave, which would highly have promoted the interest of hell. And do but observe the reason why Christ calls him Satan. Thou savorest not the things which be of God, and so on, verse 23. The things of God and the things of man, and savoring the things of God and the things of man, are set in opposition. And a man that savors not the things of God but the things of man, such a man as Satan are all one and the same in the account of Christ. So by Christ sometimes it's not meant a particular person but a nature. Christ in you, the hope of glory. Colossians 1:27. What in one place is called the divine nature is by Paul called Christ, not the person of Christ, but the nature of Christ, i.e., that spiritual principle of grace or new nature, which is an earnest of your future inheritance, and so a ground of hope. A natural man is wholly carnal, Romans 7:18. There is no good thing dwells in him, no good principle. It may lodge a while, but it has no settled abode, and what is not good is of the devil. As God is the author of all good, so is the devil of all moral evil, so that a natural man is wholly diabolical. Number two, every natural man is a friend to the devil. There are but two sovereigns in the world, one rightful and the other usurping. If we are enemies to the right sovereign, we must be friends to the usurper. If enemies to God, friends to the devil. He works in the children of disobedience, Ephesians 2, 2 and 3, not by force, but by consent. For he works in them according to the desires of the flesh, which the apostle implies, fulfilling the desires of the flesh, verse 3. If the love of the world be enmity to God, the friendship of the world is enmity with God, James 4, 4. Then enmity to God must needs be a love of the devil. Enmity to God implying a friendship with everything that has the same disposition against him. The love of the world, i.e., of the sin and unrighteousness of the world, necessarily includes virtually love of the God of the world, which is the devil's title, 2 Corinthians 4:4. And so a man adores Satan as a god, and loving that world the devil is a god of, that wickedness the devil is the head of, above God. Rebellion against God is called a covenant with death, and an agreement with hell. Isaiah 28:18, not with the punishments, but principles of hell. And being a friend of the devil, he must needs be a friend to the grand design of the devil. Isaiah 14, 12-14. And verse 4 was spoke to the king of Babylon. The knot of friendship in the world is some particular man's design, which both friends agree in and drive on. Now his design seems to be affecting the throne and authority of God. For God threatening the king of Babylon, and in him as a type the great Antichrist, compares him to Lucifer, who is not content with his station as a subject, but would mount into the chair of the supreme power. Number 3. Your enmity against God is in some respect as much in regard of the actual effects of it as the devil's is, though not in regard of disposition. We declare our enmity as far as we can. We cannot pull God out of heaven. We cannot nail Christ to the cross again and pierce his heart. We cannot rail at him to his face as the Jews did. But the despising his laws, disowning his power granted by heaven over us, is the only thing we can do against him. And this we do as much as we can, as much as the gripes of conscience and our interest in the world will give us leave. We virtually deprive him of that which was the reward of his sufferings, namely his power, of the design of his sufferings, namely the propagation of his evangelical law in our heart. And he that would destroy the dear things God and Christ have left in the world, and that which he gave the greatest charge for the preservation of, would act all the villainies against the person of Christ, as well as against what he had in the world, and against the essence of God, were it in his power. Thou dost as much in this as the devil can do. The being of God and the person of Christ are above his reach as well as ours. All that he can do is to trample upon his laws and list others in rebellion against God, and in this you comply with him. He can do no more, and you do as much. Number 4. It is worse enmity than is in hell. This enmity is more disingenuous than that in hell. Our hatred of God is worse than that of the damned. They despairingly hate him under the inevitable and unavoidable strokes of justice. You hate him while you are hedged in with the expressions of his goodness. They hate him under vials of wrath, and we under showers of mercy. They in terror of damnation, and we under the sense of kindness. They hate him because he inflicts what is hurtful, and we because he commands what is profitable and holy. Our hatred of God is worse than the devil's hatred of him. We hate God who contrived our redemption and sent his Son to accomplish it. The devils had not those obligations laid upon them. Christ came not for them, nor shed his blood for their recovery. They hate their Creator, but we our Creator and Redeemer too. The devils hate him that came to torment them and destroy their works. We hate him that come to bless us and save our souls. Number 2. Information. God is the greatest evil in the account of every natural man. If there be in us a greater enmity to God and his law than to anything else, it implies that we think him the greatest evil and the worst of beings. Evil and not good is the object of hatred. is love is a propension of the mind to something as good, so hatred is an alienation of the mind from something as evil, either really or supposedly. We cannot possibly hate good as good, as we cannot possibly love evil as evil. Now, nothing but sin is absolutely evil, and therefore nothing but sin should be the absolute object of our hatred. But seeing that love, which should be set upon God, is set upon sin, and that hatred, which should have only sin for its object, pitches upon God as its object, it is hence clear that we account sin the highest good, and God the greatest evil. Though a man does not hate God as God, yet there being more of his hatred spent against God than against anything else, it is most certain that God is virtually accounted by us a most detestable being. Do we offend any so much as we do God? Do we love the prosecution of anything which is distasteful to man, as we do that which is an abomination to God? Is there anything in the world we do more rejoice in than that whereby God is prejudiced? Is there anything we do love and pursue with greatest violence than that which is hateful and injurious to him? Are we so absolutely contrary to any man, any creature, in our natural inclinations, dispositions, affections, and desires as unto God? Is it not clearly manifest by our inward, outward carriage that we imply that God is the greatest evil, and we rank him who is unchangeably good in the place of sin, which is unchangeably bad? As love is carried out in desire for the object beloved, so hatred is a flight from it. As love is accompanied with joy at the presence of a beloved object, so is hatred attended with a detestation. Are we not naturally more desirous of opportunities of sin than opportunities of service to our Maker? Are we ever so cheerful in the presence of God and communion with him in religious services as in our sports, recreations, and sinful practices? What then has most of our love? What do we account our supreme happiness and our worst misery? Number 3, information. It justifies God in his acts of punitive justice, in his severest judgments in the world. Who can blame God for his severities against those that hate him, especially after riches of forbearance? Consider man as his desperate enemy, and you may more admire his clemency than accuse his justice. You may wonder that he does not destroy the whole stock of mankind, as well as send some few drops and hailstones of judgment upon the world. We may rather stand amazed at his patience, that he suffers such creatures to live, than murmur at his judgments. For not a day but we commit many acts which manifest his hatred. For as all actions truly good partake of the nature of love to the chiefest good, so all unworthy actions which are at a distance from God, the chief end, are marshaled by and tinctured with that enmity which lurks in the soul. It is equal God should be a judge to condemn where he is rejected as a sovereign to rule. Number 2. It justifies God in his judgment upon infants. Indeed, we call infants innocent, and we are startled at the pain and suffering of babes. But this doctrine is a sufficient curb to any accusations of God in such proceedings. Do we not kill vipers and noxious creatures in the nest? Infants are endued with an inimical and hostile nature against God, though they exert it not by reason of the weakness of their organs. If death reigned over them that had not sinned, after the similitude of Adam's transgression, Romans 5:14, enmity surely reigned over them. The frost which, by congealing a viper, suspends its motion, does not expel its natural venom, which it hath in as great a quantity as the liveliest, though at present it binds up the activity of it, which will show itself when outward impediments are removed by heat. Neither does the inability of infants exercising this enmity discharge their nature from an inconceivable mass of it. Nay, you may perceive some starts of it even in them. Did you never see envy, passion, sensuality in an infant? We may more wonder that God does not dash them in pieces at their first appearance in the world, as we do young wolves and ravenous creatures, than that he should use his right over them for their original privity and take them out of the world. Number three, it justifies the eternity of punishment. Who can charge God with injustice for punishing eternally a creature who doth eternally hate him, to keep that person and be into his everlasting damage, that does wish, and if it were in his power, would accomplish the destruction of God himself? Can any punishment be too hard, any duration of it too long for him that is an enemy to the best of beings, to one infinitely good and therefore disingenuous, to one infinitely powerful and therefore intolerably foolish? Number four, what an admirable prospect may we take here of God's patience. With what astonishment may we review all the former as well as the present age of God's forbearance towards men, that he should preserve such a crew of disingenuous monsters as we all naturally are. Or despisest thou the riches of his goodness and forbearance and long-suffering? Romans 2, verse 4. Had he not had riches of goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering, and infinite riches too, the enmity of man against him had exhausted all before this time. And being the riches of goodness as well as long-suffering, it makes our enmity appear the blacker. A grain of goodness is no fit object for hatred, much less riches of it. How many millions of such haters of him breathe every day in his air, are maintained by his bounty, have their tables spread and their cups filled to the brim, and that in the maddest of their reiterated belchings out of this enmity against him, under sufficient provocations to the highest indignation. Number five, hence we see the root of all sin in the world. What is the reason men row against the stream of their own consciences? What is the reason men of sublimated reason and clear natural wisdom are voluntary slaves to their own lusts, which they serve with this delightful and disgraceful a drudgery against the light of their own minds? It is from this contrariety to God seated in their very nature. They could never else so earnestly, so cheerfully do the devil's work before God's. They can never else be deaf to the loud voice of God and have their ears open to the least whisper of Satan. Whence proceeds our stupidity, the folly of our thoughts, the levity of our minds, the deadness of our affections, the sleepiness of our souls, our inexcusable carelessness and holy duties more than anything of a temporal concern, but from this aversion from God? It is this enmity that dulls our hearts in any service, though conscience, which is in us, to keep up the interest of God's law, spurs us on to duty, yet sin, that is within us, that keeps up the quarrel against heaven, hinders us from it, or diverts us in it. Number six. Hence follows the necessity of regeneration. This division between God and his creature will not admit of any union without a change of nature. The carnal mind as such can never be reconciled to God before this be wrought. The old frame must be demolished and a new one reared, for a change of state cannot be without a change of nature. It is impossible that this nature so corrupt and contrary can ever be reconciled to the pure and holy nature of God. What communion has light with darkness? We must be God's friends before we can be sin's enemies. The root of bitterness must be taken away, habitual corruption removed. The heart will never else stand right as a compass towards heaven. Who can ever fight against his nature? No man will ever resist a devil without a change. We cannot, without the rooting out this enmity, make a profitable approach to God. What expectation can you have of a good look from him when you come to him with all your natural hatred of him? How can you dare to come to him who knows every circumstance of your enmity better than you do your name and is so well acquainted with your heart? What hopes can you have of any assurance from him if we bring our wickedness with us to Gilgal, the place of worship? Even there in the solemnest duties will God hate us. All their wickedness is in Gilgal, for there I hated them. Hosea 9:15. If the mind be filled with hostile principles against the purity of God's commands, It must be inexperienced and inactive in every work. To every good work, reprobate. Titus 1:16. If the head be sick, needs must the heart be faint. If the counseling faculty be false, cursed must be all its advice. 7. That is not grace which does not alter nature. Morality, therefore, is not grace, because it does not change nature. If it did, many of the heathens were as near to God as the best of Christians. Whatsoever may be done by the strength of nature cannot alter it, for no nature can change itself. Poison may be great within the skin, like to a viper's. Be we never so speckled with a reformation. Freedom from gross sins argues not a friendship to God. None were so great enemies to Christ as the Pharisees, to whom Christ gives no better a title than that of the devil's children, and charges them with the hatred both of himself and his Father. John 15:24. The enmity may be the greater under a zealous and devout morality. The poor publicans crowded into Christ, while the self-righteous Jews derided him and rejected the counsel of God and put the word of God from them. Luke 7:30. Acts 13:46. It is a foolish thing for men to boast of their own heart or outward conformity. You cannot tell how soon your heart you boast of may boil out as enmity. The plant which is pleasant to the eye may be poisoned to the stomach. Boast not therefore of your glossy morality, your checkered skin, so long as there is a venom in your nature. Whatsoever excellencies a natural man has are all tainted with this poison. His wisdom, learning, moral virtue are rather aggravations than excuses. 8. Hence follows the necessity of applying to Christ. As there is a necessity of a change of nature in us because our enmity to God is a moral enmity, so there is a necessity of a compensation and satisfaction to God for the preservation of God's honor, because it is an unjust enmity, not rising from any injury that ever God did to us, and because his enmity to us provoked by our disaffection to him is a legal enmity, his law violated must be satisfied. Our enmity is unjust and therefore must be parted with. God's enmity against us is just and therefore must be removed by a satisfaction. And since we are unable to give God a compensation for our wrongs, we must have recourse by faith to that blood which has given him a complete satisfaction. It is Christ only that satisfied God for us by the shedding of his blood and removes our enmity by the operation of his Spirit. 9. See hence the reason of the difficulty of conversion and the little success the gospel has. All the words in the world will not change nature. Men strive against the Spirit and will not come under the power of it, if they might have their own will. Can you by exhortations ever reconcile a wolf and a lamb? Can you by rational arguments new mold the nature of a fierce lion, or by moral discourses stop the tide of the sea? Though man be a rational creature, yet corrupt habits in him answer to mere nature in them, and sway in Titus as much against God. Grave discourses can never set a man straight that is born crooked. It is no easy thing for the heart of man, possessed so long by this cursed principle, to surrender itself upon God's summons. Men are not so easily reconciled when the hatred has been hereditary in the family. This has been of as long a standing within a few hours as Adam himself. To turn to God in ways of righteousness is contrary to the stream of corrupt nature, and therefore it must be overpowered by a flood of almighty grace, as the stream of the river is by the tide of the sea. 10. If there be such an enmity against the sovereignty of God in the heart of man, this shows us the excellency of obedience. It is the endeavor of the creature as much as in him lies to exalt God, to keep him upon his throne, to preserve the scepter in his hand and the crown upon his head. As faith is a setting a seal to the truth of God, so is obedience a setting a seal to the dominion of God and subscribing to the righteousness thereof. It is called a confirmation of God's law, an affection to the honor of it, Cursed be he that confirms not all the words of this law to do them. Deuteronomy 27:26. It is an establishing, it is a standing infallible rule, and consequently an establishing the lawgiver, and an applause to the righteousness of his government. God be in the highest perfection and infinitely good, therefore whatsoever rule he gives the creature must be good and amiable, or else it cannot proceed from God. A base and vile thing can never proceed from that which is only excellent. An unreasonable thing can never proceed from that which is altogether reason and regular. Therefore, the obedience to God's law is in acknowledging the excellent goodness, love, wisdom, righteousness of the lawgiver, and a bearing witness to it in the face of the world. Number 2. Application. Examination. Examine yourselves by those demonstrations laid down in the first part, whether this enmity be prevalent in you or not. Number 1. Have you yet a stoutness of heart against hearing the law of God, which crosses the desires of the flesh? Number 2. Are you unwilling to be determined by divine injunctions? Number 3. Does your heart swell most against those laws which are most spiritual, and which God does most strictly urge? Number 4. Do you fall out and quarrel with your own consciences when they press upon you any command of God? Number 5. Do you countenance that law in your members, that law of sin, in opposition to the law of your mind? Number 6. Are you willing to be at more pains and expense to violate God's law than to observe it and preserve the honor of it? Number 7. Do you perform things materially righteous because of the agreeableness of them to your humor and constitution, out of respect to your reputation, or which is worse, out of an affection to some base lust and carnal end, or out of a slavish fear of God? Number 8. Are the laws of men more valued and feared by you than the laws of God? Do you more readily obey them? Number 9. Are you desirous and diligent in the drawing men from compliance with God's laws to be your companions in any sin you are addicted to? Number 10. Do you take pleasure in the affronts men offer to God, and make them the matter of your sport and jollity? So much as you find of this temper in any of your souls, so much of enmity there is. Number 3. Application. Exhortation. Number 1. To sinners, lay down thy arms against God. How can ye hear these things without saying, Lord, deliver me from this nature? Oh, what should I be an enemy to so good a God? Did God put enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent? And shall I put enmity between God and my soul, and a love between my heart and the serpent? Shall I change this promise of God and make my dearest affections embrace a serpent seed, and refuse God himself? Lay down thy cudgels, strip yourself, yield yourself to him upon his own terms. How can you sit down at rest in hating God and be hated by him? While you are in your natural condition, you cannot be a friend to God, for they that are in the flesh cannot please him. Romans 8:8. How can two walk together unless they be agreed? We must change our enmity into friendship if ever we would be happy. We must accept of his terms to be at peace with him, or feel the bitter fruits of his powerful justice. We may pronounce in the presence of God that if we henceforward endeavor not to get out of a natural state, it is a resolute maintaining the war against heaven. Lament this enmity and be humbled for it. If there be a common ingenuity, it will make you tremble to think of your hatred of mercy itself. Every sin is a branch of this enmity and does contribute to the increase of it, as acts, strength, and habits, and as every part of the sea, according to its quantity and strength, contributes to the roaring and violent eruptions of it. We have robbed God, for as much as obedience as we have given to the flesh, we have taken from God. Therefore rise as high as a fountain in your humiliations, and lie low, not for a particular sin only, but for that enmity in your nature which is the root of all the sins you ever acted. The evil in our actions is transient. But there is a perfect and overflowing fullness of evil in your nature to animate a thousand acts of the same kind as a habit of love to God resident in your soul can command in spirit a thousand acts with its own nature. Use of exhortation to regenerate persons, such as by the powerful working of the grace of God and the overruling hand of the Spirit, have been brought out of the state of enmity. Besides those things which you may gather from the former informations, is to grow up in all parts of the new creature, to further and advance that regenerate work in your soul, to make frequent applications of the blood of Christ, and to have your heart lifted up in the ways of God and obedience to Him, thereby to bear witness to Christ, the righteousness of God as His administrations in the world. Let me advise to thee things first. Possess your hearts with great admiration of the grace of God towards you and wounding this enmity in your hearts and changing your state. The apostle winds up our admirations of the love of Christ upon this peg. When we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of His Son. Much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by His life. Romans 5:10. Our salvation from sin by regeneration is the fruit of His resurrection and life. As our salvation from the guilt of sin by satisfaction was a fruit of His death. And not only so, he says, but we also joy in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom we now receive the atonement, verse 11. This reconciliation of us being the fruit of the first promise of breaking the serpent's head, Genesis 3:15, i.e. the projects and designs of the devil to set God and man at eternal variance, makes it the more admirable that as soon as man had, immediately after his creation, and being made lord of the rest of the sublunary creatures, cast off his lord and creator, that just at that time, under the present sense of that unworthy slight, he should be laying about for the good of fallen man, and make a promise for the dissolving this enmity, and change this resistance of God into a more righteous one, namely a variance with and an eternal enmity against the serpent. And has not been this the case of our souls, that God has grappled with us and changed the current of our wills, even at the very time of the spitting out of our venomous disaffection against Him? It was Paul's case and the case of many, I am sure, since that time. If such a circumstance as this did attend your first conversion, it should, methinks, enlarge your notes and wind up your astonishment to a higher pitch. But howsoever it be, change your complaints into praises for your deliverance. Though it be as yet imperfect, a lively and warm sense of it would quicken your obedience and spirit thee more in the ways of God than all your complaints can do. It is to the grace of God that we owe the decays of it. It is a particular assisting grace that keeps it down and binds it up at any time. If we are sometimes without considerable disturbances by it, it is not for lack of the will of the flesh, nor for lack of strength enough in the flesh, even in the best of men, but it is staked down and stopped by the powerful operation of the Spirit and the working of irresistible grace. To this purpose, often reflect upon your former state. It will set a gloss upon the grace of God. The more disingenuous our enmity was, the more illustrious will it make the love of God to appear in our eye. Number 2, endeavor to hate sin as much as you have hated God. What reason have we to bewail ourselves? None of us have ever yet hated sin so much as naturally we have hated God. Turn this affection now as much upon your great enemy as you have done upon your best friend. The deeper gashes you have given to God, Christ, and His glory, the wider wounds, the harder blows, the sharper stabs give to your sin. Have as great an animosity against it as you have had stoutness of heart against God. Come not under the power of anyone. Lift up your hand most against spiritual sins. Show no obedience to the law of sin in your members. Number 3. Inflame your love to God by all the considerations you can possibly muster up. Outdo your former disaffection by a greater ardency of love. Sincerely aim at His glory. By His command only in everything you do. Delight to please Him above yourself. Endeavor by all means to draw others to think well of Him and to be at peace with Him. Take pleasure in the conversion of others to Him. Rejoice at any glory He gains in the world. The unjust enmity he receives from others should procure a greater respect from us to God. Oh, that we can make up by an intenseness of love the injury he receives by the enmity of others, and balance their hatred by an increase of our affection. Oh, that we could delight ourselves in him as much as we have been displeased with him, that he might be as dear to us as he is odious to devils, and that the devil themselves and the degrees of their detestation of God might not outstrip us in the degrees of our affection to him. Number 4, be well this enmity. Are the best of us perfect? Are we stripped of all relics of it? Is any man on earth put off the dregs of the flesh and commenced an angel in purity? Have we got the start of all the saints of old and expelled it wholly out of us? Have we outstripped the great apostle who complained of sins dwelling in his flesh? Is there no more need of groans to be delivered from this body of death? Ah, what relics are there? Does not the best man find it a laborious undertaking to engage against the remainders of nature in him, and to manage a constant and open hostility against the force of the sensual appetite and the spiritual wickedness in the high places of a soul, though much wounded by the grace of God? It is this gasping body of death in a regenerate man that gives life to those swarms of imperfections in his religious duties. It is this that cripples our obedience and shackles our feet when they should run the ways of God's commandments. It is this drags away our heart after unworthy objects in the midst of those services in which we attempt the nearest approaches to God. It is upon the score of this lurking principle in us that we may charge all the foils we suffer in our strongest wrestling for heaven. Stephen Charnock.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.